Hello. On this week's program, we speak with Jeffrey Siegel. He's at the Kimmel Center's Paramount Theater on Monday for the second of three keyboard conversations. Jason Pfeiffer looks ahead to the People's Light and Theatre's production of Arthur Miller's The Crucible and looks back at the life of the great playwright who died just 1 year ago. And in our regular look inside the Culture File section of GoPhila.com, Susan Lewis explores the Fairmount Waterworks Interpretive Centre in Philadelphia. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Jeffrey Siegel's keyboard conversations are concert plus commentary performances in which the world-renowned pianist speaks about, then plays, great piano works. These witty, informative presentations provide newcomers to classical music with an entry point for understanding the form, while seasoned listeners often gain a deeper insight and appreciation of familiar and sometimes less familiar works. Siegel has been hosting keyboard conversations for 35 years now, inviting discussions from audience members and answering questions about music that they might otherwise be afraid to ask. He's at the Kimmel Center's Parliament Theatre on Monday to explain why there's more to Mozart than Amadeus. The last time he was in town, he dropped by WRTI.
Most of my colleagues read the biographies of the composers and letters of the composers and works about the works of these composers. My job, as I see it, is to take this research knowledge and to make it relevant and accessible to the concert goer who doesn't even need to know the difference between a minor and a major chord, for example, and to, without using any technical language, to be able to distill this information and in a very short time, very briefly, get this across to the listener with the sole purpose of making his listening experience more meaningful than it would otherwise be. So, of course, as an interpreter, one is constantly searching and learning. But for the keyboard conversation process, it's what do you do with all of this? How do you get this across to the listener in a short time without overwhelming him so that instead of a concert with commentary, it becomes a lecture with musical examples? I don't want that, and neither does the listener. It should be very brief and just to prepare the listener to hear the music.
And how much does your pre-performance talk vary from night to night?
When I was younger, I had a very general outline of what I wanted to say. And I found on stage in the heat of the moment that the right descriptive adjectives were not there and that I wasn't quite sure what the next point was that I wanted to make with the music. And I thought I would wing it, and more often than not, it was terrible, which unfortunately is the case, I'm sorry to say, with a lot of people who talk about music. It requires enormous preparation. I wouldn't say that I have a script per se, and I don't stand at a lectern. It's nothing like that. But in my mind, I have a very detailed, very specific outline of the musical points that I want to make and sometimes specific descriptive adjectives so that I don't at the moment have to search for the right word to describe this or that. Very often there's been a beautiful word that has been written by a great writer that I simply borrow for the occasion and I have it at my fingertips. I find, therefore, the better prepared I am and the more detailed it is in its worked out state, the more free and spontaneous I can be. And most people who attend the keyboard conversations do not feel lectured to. They really feel it's conversational. I'm inviting them into the listening and process, and that's what I'm trying to get across.
You've been doing this for going on 35 years, and in that time, the way people consume music has changed radically. I mean, we talked, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago about the MTV generation, whatever that was. Mm-hmm. And we now have supposedly, certainly young people and people who've come to adulthood over the last 20 years, who, it is said, a lot of the time don't have the capacity for long-term focus. Has your approach to your delivery or how you've structured the conversations changed, or have you perceived that people's attention spans have gotten shorter?
I certainly would agree that the attention span has gotten much shorter. It seems that everybody's got the channel changer in their hand, and if the moment that they lose interest in something, they want to change the channel. And this is one of the diseases of our age. It's interesting you mentioned this because I do a program called Schubert in the Age of the Soundbite. What do you do with a composer who's written a 35-minute piano sonata, which is one of the great treasures of all the music literature, when the attention span is going to be 3 minutes, maybe? And that's exactly the theme of that particular program. And my hope is that the listener is ready to take the long journey, and you realize with the listener that there are certain signposts along the way to guide him through, and to realize why, indeed, there is what Schumann called about Schubert's music a heavenly length, that these ideas need time to be expanded upon. And then there is the unrushed feeling of going through these incomparable musical treasures that is part of what this music is about. And it's been a great joy for me to realize that once the audience is ready for the expanded musical joy of, let's say, the B-flat Schubert sonata, they realize why this composition has the long arc that it has, and they want to go along on the journey. But I couldn't agree with you more. I think the danger of having concerts made up of two-minute pieces is very great.
And one that you continue to resist.
I continue to resist it, but I also do another program called The Longevity of the Short Piece, which is made up entirely of pieces of music that are probably no longer than 3-4 minutes in length. Grieg lyric pieces, Mendelssohn's Song Without Words, lots of different Chopin and Liszt pieces where brevity is very much the soul of these composers' wit. Rachmaninoff said it very well. It's harder to write a short piece than a long piece because there's no place to pad. Everything has to fit. Everything has to be relevant. And the preludes of Rachmaninoff are also on that program. And the idea of the concise musical idea, where in 2 minutes so much is being said, that's the other side of the question, so to speak. I should really do the Schubert program, the heavenly length, and the short piece program in the same season. That would be an interesting mix.
Jeffrey Siegel. He's at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre on Monday to explain and demonstrate musically why there's more to Mozart than Amadeus. It's the second in a 3-part series of Keyboard Conversations. Almost exactly a year ago, playwright Arthur Miller died at his home in Roxbury, Connecticut, at the age of 89. Since the New York-born writer is widely regarded as one of the most significant dramatists of the 20th century, it comes as no surprise that there's been a renewed interest in performing his work. This Friday, the People's Light and Theatre in Malvern, PA, opens Miller's 1953 play The Crucible, a classic work that's regularly performed around the world. Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer takes a closer look at the legacy of this much-lauded play and its creator.
Late in his life, Arthur Miller reflected that when he wrote The Crucible in the early 1950s, it was an act of desperation.
I would like to give you the names of some of the individuals who have appeared before our one-man committee.
With Senator Joseph McCarthy at the helm of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, and with anti-communism gaining momentum, many reputations and careers were severely damaged by mere accusations of being communist sympathizers in that era. Miller observed a widespread paralysis among people who were reluctant to protest the rampant blacklisting and risk becoming objects of suspicion themselves. Frustrated with the political climate, Miller decided to address the hysteria. But rather than write directly about McCarthyism and the Red Scare, Miller opted to set a play in 17th century Massachusetts. He based the narrative on the events surrounding the Salem witch trials of 1692. Records indicate that 19 men and women were convicted and hung in Salem that year as a result of young girls claiming they were bewitched by members of the community and possessed by the devil. As Miller witnessed the McCarthy hearings, he couldn't help but draw parallels to the Salem village's panic. Miller wrote The Crucible in about a year, and the play opened on Broadway on January 22, 1953. Steve Santola, a Miller scholar, friend of the author, and English professor at Millersville University in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, says the premiere of the play received a cold reception.
Subsequent to that experience back in the 1950s, The Crucible ultimately became Arthur Miller's most frequently produced play. So if I were to try to identify the greatest achievements of Arthur Miller as a writer, I'd have to say Death of a Salesman number one and A Crucible number two.
Dramas like All My Sons, After the Fall, and The Price are some of the other well-known plays by Miller, but his body of work extends far beyond these few stories. During his 60-year career, he wrote well over 25 plays. David Bradley, director of The Crucible at the People's Light and Theatre, notes that nearly all of the writer's creations demonstrated solid craftsmanship.
Miller was a great carpenter, in addition to being a great writer. He built wonderful furniture. And his plays are kind of like that. The leg fits into the joint, which supports the surface of the table in a masterful way, and there's not a step missed, and there's not an inch off. And you get that right, and that's pretty thrilling to have happen in the theater.
In addition to writing for the theater, Miller also wrote novels, essays, short stories, and screenplays. Over 4 decades after the stage version of The Crucible premiered, Miller wrote the screenplay for the 1996 film, starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Winona Ryder.
I saw your face when she put me out. You loved me then, and you do now.
Abby, I may think of you softly from time to time, but I will cut off my hand before I reach for you again.
In the People's Light production of The Crucible, Juliana Zinkel and Christopher Patrick Mullen play the lead roles of John Proctor and Abigail Williams.
But I will cut off my hand before I'll ever reach for you again. Wipe it out of mind. We never touched, Abby.
Aye, but we did.
Aye, but we did not.
The story reveals that while John once had an affair with the younger Abigail, he has since distanced himself from her at the prompting of his wife, Elizabeth. As Abigail gains clout in the village by supposedly being able to identify those possessed by the devil, the jealous girl soon charges Elizabeth with practicing witchcraft. In the People's Light staging, Susan McKee plays Elizabeth Proctor. It's her first outing in a Miller play.
It's the mark of a truly wonderful play, when you can continue to find new things. I have no doubt that on the 7th week of production, you know, at 10 a.m. some morning, I'm going to be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just realized that about this. It's just remarkable writing in that sense. And I think that's why people do it over and over and over again. These people are 400 years old to us, you know, they're so far away. But if we listen to it, we will continue to learn from it.
Steve Santola of Millersville University agrees. He says that many of the issues raised in the play concerning free speech and fear of enemies continue to resonate today, just as it was relevant in the context of McCarthyism in the 1950s and the Salem witch trials of the 1690s.
Arthur Miller once commented to me in one of my interviews that it was interesting to him that when a country throws off the mantle of oppression that's been holding the people down and they move towards a more democratic society, the first play from an American playwright that they want to produce in that country is The Crucible. And it's like that play speaks to them about what they just endured and survived. And so clearly, if that's been the historical track record for that play, then it's a play that will endure because we're always going to have those kinds of transformations taking place in the world.
Millersville University professor and Arthur Miller scholar Steve Santola ending that report by WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. The People's Light and Theatre in Malvern opens Miller's The Crucible this Friday. It runs through April 9th. Now it's time for our regular look inside the Culture File section of GoPhila.com. Susan Lewis takes us on a visit to the Fairmount Waterworks in Philadelphia.
There's a place in East Fairmount Park where you can stand on dry land and feel as if you're in the middle of the river. Well, almost. At the very end of a promenade, the sound of rushing water almost eclipses the buzz of traffic on the expressway. Look down and you can see where the tide finally stops, here, swirling at the base of the dam. On one side, tidal seawater. On the other, fresh river water, which on the day we visit looks crystal clear. From a distance, the attached buildings at River's Edge, with graceful arches, wide white columns, and elegant rooftop statuary, could belong to the art museum above them on the hill. The Fairmount Waterworks doesn't look like a public utility. But then again, when it was built, people had more reverence for the idea. At least, they didn't take it for granted. The city's first water distribution system was an 1801 pumping station on Center Square, where City Hall sits now. But it didn't have adequate capacity, and the city, nestled then between about 10th Street and the Delaware River, needed new sources of clean water. When the city's watering committee selected Frederick Graff to build a new pumping station, the bank of the Schuylkill was a logical site, as Drew Brown, the Philadelphia Water Department's manager of public education programs, explains.
This was the wilderness here on this side of Philadelphia, and there were no communities upstream depositing any wastes in the river. Then the hilltop was here, Fairmount, which is about 90 feet above the river level. So you've got the advantage of the elevation here, the hilltop as well.
An engine house was built between 1812 and 1815 in the style of a federal country house. In it, two state-of-the-art steam engines drew water from the river and pumped it up the rocky cliff to the reservoir on the top of the hill. Then gravity kicked in to distribute the water back down the 3 miles or so to the heart of the city. Although the steam engines worked, they caused explosions and by 1821 were replaced by water wheels. A dam, the longest in the world for many years, was built across the Schuylkill, redirecting water behind and through a new mill house. But there were still hitches. At high tide, the water level rose enough to stop the wheels from turning for about 6 hours a day. To remedy this, horizontal hydraulic turbines were installed, and the operation became not only a functional success, but a critical marvel, drawing visitors from all over the world. The city was also aware by then that sources of clean water could no longer be taken for granted. If you've ever looked at a map of Philadelphia and wondered why the footprint of the city's immense park stretches out and away from Center City in such an irregular way, the plan was, well, anything but random, as the Water Department's General Manager of Public Affairs, Ed Gruszewski, describes.
They understood 180 years ago concepts of watersheds. And so an integral part of the development of the Fairmount system was the development of Fairmount Park, where they put aside land to prevent development, to protect the city's drinking water.
Despite such efforts, over time, the river, used for so long as both a source of drinking water and a sewer, became too polluted for use. In 1909, the pumping station closed. The reservoir would become the site for the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Over the next decades, the waterworks building was put to different uses, an aquarium, then as a swimming pool. But the still polluted, malodorous river made outside activities less attractive. In the last quarter of the 20th century, the Clean Water Act of 1972 was enacted, which over time would help make the riverbank a more pleasant place to visit. The Fairmount Waterworks was declared a National Historic Landmark, and efforts began to restore it as a historic site. In 2003, the Waterworks Interpretive Center opened for visitors. Two William Rush sculptures sit on top of the entrances to the old mill house, the male Schuylkill chained, fighting against locks and dam, and the female Schuylkill freed, under which the visitors enter and descend into a series of rooms with exposed stone walls and high arched waterfront windows. Here you can see an 1851 turbine, pump, and wet well, and watch an orientation film in the 1815 engine house, where the pipe that led up the hill to the reservoir is still in place. Pollutionopolis, a kid's favorite, is a sculpture of mud, bottles, auto parts, toilets, garbage, you name it, inspired by the debris collected at the base of the dam. The star attraction is a video monitor with a live feed to the fish ladder, which is kind of an underwater detour that allows fish and other creatures to swim beyond the dam. Last spring, the first American river otter seen here in over 100 years was captured on the video as it swam, pausing for a moment at the camera as if to say hi. This is but one of many indicators that the water quality is improving, something educator Karen Young is keen to impress upon young visitors.
Every drop of water that comes to them comes from almost within walking distance to where they live. We don't think twice about the amount of time and energy and expense to clean both sources of water coming into us and leaving us.
Only a decade or so shy of its 200th birthday, the Waterworks continues to reaffirm its bond to Philadelphia's people, the land, and perhaps its most intimate partner, the river. The water, now cleaner, continues to flow past, stroking the shore, pausing perhaps before tumbling over the dam to salute this partnership, which as much as any other, has created and nurtured the city.
Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis. More information on the Fairmount Waterworks Interpretive Center can be found at the Culture Files section of gophilla.com. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Aaron Palmer, Paul Marotta, Mary Bashaw, Ellen Dilks, and Paula Butler. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.